Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Claire Woodcock. This week, tensions mount as the Colorado legislature ends its session.
Two ninth graders are awarded a grant to help us have a bird's eye view with an Osprey cam, that is.
Basalt looks into buying the infamous Pan and Fork property outright.
And we talk with Nancy Rice, the Chief Justice of the Colorado Supreme Court.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron has joined 17 other elected officials around the state urging Colorado's congressmen to support the Bureau of Land Management's methane rule. Carolyn Zachariasen has the details.
A letter signed by 18 mayors of the cities and towns around the state was sent yesterday to Senators Cory Gardner and Michael Bennett. The letter states how the rule ensures fair return to taxpayers, improves our air quality, and cuts energy waste. The mayors are opposing a proposal to block rules issued by the BLM to limit natural gas waste. They note that Colorado's natural gas production continues to grow, despite that the state adopted the nation's first ever rule to cut methane waste and pollution 2 years ago. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
A bipartisan measure to give people in rural Colorado financial help to cover high health insurance costs failed in a state Senate committee this week. Benta Berkland has more.
Republican and Democratic county commissioners from the Western Slope were among those testifying in support of the measure. Republican Senator Don Corum of Montrose is one of the main sponsors of House Bill 1235.
This is a Band-Aid. I understand that. Frankly, we're all in a dilemma because we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level on health care. But I do know that the citizens of rural Colorado, especially my area, we have been priced out of the market.
Under the bill, people on the Western Slope, Eastern Plains, and Southern Colorado would receive a stipend if more than 15% of their salary goes to pay health insurance premiums. To qualify, they would have to earn less than 500% of the federal poverty level. Republican Senator Vicki Marble of Fort Collins voted against the bill.
I can't say that taking money from taxpayers to cover something that government caused is going to fix the problem.
Ultimately, it was defeated along party lines in the Senate State Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
On Tuesday, Basalt officials agreed to hire a public finance consultant to look into how the town could swing buying the Pan and Fork property. Wyatt reports.
All but one of Basalt's council members voted to hire Eller's Public Finance. Auden Schendler voted no. The town will pay the consultant between $7,500 and $8,000. Bruce Kimmel of Eller's will look into ways the town could finance the Pan and Fork property. Davis Ferrer is Basalt's interim town manager. During the council's work session, he said it'd be best if a third party looked into the issue. The public then could be confident the analysis isn't biased. Schendler said he was concerned that spending money on the Pan and Fork would mean not spending in other areas that also need the town's attention.
Tempers are flaring in the final weeks of Colorado's annual legislative session, and some of the top priorities for lawmakers are in serious jeopardy. Benta Berkland has more.
It's unusual for the Senate president to bring reporters into his office for a hastily called press conference. But that's exactly what Kevin Grantham did on Thursday. The reason? It was to explain why a bipartisan bill seeking to ask voters to raise the sales tax for transportation could soon be dead.
It's always been known that 1242 was going to have struggles when we got to finance or when we got to appropriations just because of the makeup of the committees. No matter how you slice it, this comes down to a sales tax increase. I'm not sure what ornaments we can hang on this tree that will make that not as important as it is.
The tax is a half-cent sales tax increase. Part of the money would fund a $3.5 billion bond for statewide transportation projects. It would also raise billions more for local road and transit projects. The bipartisan bill cleared its first committee, but it's expected to die in the Finance Committee.
After we trim the hedge and mow the grass, we can then look at maybe doing some more landscaping. But until that happens, I don't think it's really appropriate for us to do that.
That's Republican Senator Jack Tate of Centennial. He plans to vote no. So do the other GOP committee members who hold the majority.
And I think we should exhaust better options first.
He says one of those options is Senate Bill 267 from Republican Senator Jerry Sonnenberg of Sterling. It would add about $1 billion for transportation by using state buildings as leverage to borrow money for large infrastructure projects. It would also enterprise a fee collected by hospitals and move that money into a fund that doesn't count towards a cap on how much money the state can spend. The bill's still alive, but in limbo. Sonnenberg has delayed it after he says negotiations with Democrats broke down.
I was interested in saving hospitals, and they're interested in keeping more taxpayer dollars. I don't know where this goes from here.
There's a whole lot more in that bill that has to be fixed.
Democratic House Majority Leader Casey Becker of Boulder is co-sponsoring the bill with Sonnenberg, but she says she's long had significant reservations with it.
We all want to help the hospitals. We need to do it in a way that doesn't put us in another Tabor situation in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. That's just kicking the can down in a way that doesn't actually help.
Becker is referencing a major sticking point, the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, or Tabor cap. Republicans want to lower it. Democrats, including Senate Minority Leader Lucia Guzman of Denver, don't. They say lowering the cap would force Colorado to give refunds to voters instead of using that money for budget priorities like education.
There are ways to come together, I think, to take care of the rural hospitals.
Without the bill, hospitals could face a $500 million budget cut next year, and some rural hospitals have said they'd close their doors or drastically cut services. Guzman feels like she could help broker a deal, but she says her Democratic colleagues in the House haven't included her in all the negotiations, even though she's also one of the bill's sponsors.
I have had a very politically energized communication during the wee hours. I have said, this is my bill. As long as we are working it in the Senate, which is where it is, let us work this bill here.
For her part, Speaker of the House Crisanta Duran of Denver says it would be disappointing if both the hospital bill and transportation proposal fail.
The saddest thing about this is that we're coming forward so that we don't leave communities behind. And you know which communities are most likely to be left behind if we don't come forward with a statewide solution? It's going to be our rural communities.
But there is still some time. This year's legislative session ends on May 10th, and Senate President Kevin Grantham says he's not ready to write any obituaries just yet. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Claire Woodcock. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for up-to-the-minute news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
The publisher of the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel says he will not sue a state lawmaker over claims that the newspaper peddles fake news stories. Benta Berkland has more.
Publisher Jay Seaton still stands by his claim that Republican State Senator Ray Scott defamed the newspaper and tried to delegitimize a credible news organization after Scott tweeted the paper was fake news. Had the lawsuit gone forward, it would have been the first of its kind and could have set a legal definition for the term fake news. But Seaton says he worried the case would be difficult to win, and he says the meaning is changing.
It may actually be transforming right before our eyes into a general pejorative, which is the best defense to this kind of a case, because then it's just opinion, and opinion criticism is absolutely protected.
Another factor was that legislative attorneys could provide Scott's defense. Scott could also claim legislative immunity, which could have dragged out the case for several years. Seaton says he didn't want to tie up the courts and make taxpayers foot the bill. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
The Roaring Fork River running through Aspen is not as healthy as the city or the state think it should be. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has details. The Roaring Fork has been on Colorado's impaired rivers list for 5 years, and the city of Aspen is working with Pitkin County to put together a plan to improve its health. April Long heads up Aspen's Clean River Program.
So this stretch of the Roaring Fork River through the city of Aspen is the most threatened stretch in the entire river.
A variety of factors may be contributing to the Roaring Fork's degrading health. Water is pulled out of the river through a transbasin diversion, and lawns have replaced natural riverbank in many areas. Plus, stormwater from the city core contributes pollutants. Long and the city of Aspen have been working for years on improved stormwater systems, and now staff is looking at other projects to improve water quality. The city and county are working together to develop a river management plan, and Long says public involvement is critical. There will be an open house Thursday evening from 4 to 6 at the Old Powerhouse property in Aspen. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Improving roads and bridges is the top priority of leaders in both parties at the Colorado Legislature. But a bipartisan effort to fund transportation was killed by Republicans in the Senate Finance Committee on Tuesday. As Benta Berkland reports, the defeat of the measure was expected, but it highlights divisions within the GOP.
Republican Senate President Kevin Grantham of Canyon City was the main sponsor of House Bill 1242, which sought a tax increase to pay for a long list of state transportation needs.
We just so happen to think it's a core function of government to fund transportation infrastructure, and giving the voters that chance is the least we can do.
A coalition of business groups, mayors, and county commissioners said the bill is necessary for Colorado's growth, but it wasn't enough to sway Republicans on the committee, like Senator Tim Neville of Littleton. He says he's always been a strong no vote.
The biggest thing is I think we have money within the budget that we should be focusing on freeing up to utilize. The other piece is that bill has too much spending that is not going to where we need it, to roads and to bridges. There's a lot of transit in that bill.
The measure would have asked voters to approve a half-cent sales tax increase to raise billions of dollars for statewide projects. Many local communities supported the idea because a portion of that money was also allocated to local needs. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
Nancy Rice, the Chief Justice of the Colorado Supreme Court, was in the Roaring Fork Valley earlier this month. She met with the local bar associations and visited courthouses in the 9th Judicial District. And she also spoke with Carolyn Zachariasen.
I know you are lobbying for pay raises for the judges. What are you asking for?
So the proposal that we made was to give us 3% this year and 3% next year. I want us to be able to attract the best candidates. I want us to be able to compete in the state for people who want to become judges. It's a very, very hard job, much harder than people realize. You know, not only is it intellectually challenging, it's really emotionally challenging. It's very difficult day in and day out to be the decider between people who are sometimes very angry at each other in divorce cases or probate cases or criminal cases where you have victims who are so upset versus defendants and defendants' families or civil cases where there's a lot of money on the line. A judge in Colorado has to be a generalist. You have to be good at everything.
What do you think the future of the judicial system in Colorado looks like 10 years from now?
Well, we do have a number of baby boomer judges, so including myself. So I suspect that within 10 years, 25% of the bench will turn over. So we'll be having younger judges. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but that is going to be a difference. The leadership of the branch, I'm sure, in 10 years will be different. In terms of what we want to do within the branch in the next 10 years is figure out a better way to deal with people who are not represented by lawyers, who we call pro se litigants, P-R-O, new word, S-E, pro se. And that, I mean, that's getting to be a real issue, particularly in domestic cases, probate cases, anything that's kind of family-oriented, small claims cases, county court cases where the value of cases is $15,000 or less. And that's something we have to do a lot better, I think.
Is that because it's just so expensive to have a lawyer?
Exactly.
We've definitely seen an increase in caseload in the district, and particularly in the Pitkin County Courthouse. Part of that, I think, is that the stakes are really high here, and there's a lot of real estate deals, and we have a very complicated land use code, and developers sue our governing bodies, our local governing bodies. There's this dichotomy, I think, that happens where our local judges know the community well. They know our regulatory documents. They know what the land use code is. It means something to them. I think that inherently they use that knowledge when they're making rulings or at least considering arguments, and they understand it on a different level. Let's say in a case where a developer sues the city council because they denied a project. Local judge says, we rule in favor of the city council, and the developer appeals it to the Colorado Court of Appeals. Many times, the local elected officials aren't willing to gamble with what the decision's going to be in Denver because they feel like the judges are looking straight at case law and the arguments that are put in front of them and not really that local aspect. Can you speak to that at all?
I can tell you that, you know, a decision from a district court judge is appealed to the Court of Appeals, as you noted, and they get that appeal as of right, and then they can ask the Supreme Court to review whatever the Court of Appeals does. And the Supreme Court only takes about 7% of those cases. I mean, people are surprised to hear how low it is. And so when we decide to take a case, we're not necessarily thinking, well, did the Court of Appeals get it right or get it wrong? Although that's a factor, we're more thinking, you know, is this a case of statewide interest? Is this a case which presents a really significant legal issue that's going to have to be applied everywhere? Is this a case which is of such importance that perhaps the Supreme Court should write on it as opposed to the Court of Appeals?
You do have some cases, local cases in front of you. I know you can't speak to them, and you're bound to also not speak about cases that you've ruled on.
That's correct.
Nancy Rice, Chief Justice of the Colorado Supreme Court, thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
To hear an extended interview, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday afternoon, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Pickens County's Healthy Rivers Board handed out thousands of dollars in grants last week, including one project that has high schoolers keeping a 24-hour watch on wildlife. Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
Two ninth graders from Colorado Rocky Mountain School were awarded $933 to outfit an Osprey camera with night vision and a microphone. It was an unconventional request in a packed grant cycle, but Chair Lisa Tasker said the Healthy Rivers Board embraces the students' project.
I think that understanding what ospreys do and putting that in as a part of their scientific program made a lot of sense to us because ospreys are so connected to the river.
There will be a link to the students' Osprey cam from the Healthy Rivers website. The board awarded a total of nearly $30,000, including grants to the Aspen Global Change Institute and the Roaring Fork Conservancy. The board is still considering two larger funding requests. Colorado Parks and Wildlife is asking for $80,000 for work to protect native cutthroat trout in the Roaring Fork watershed. And the Aspen Valley Land Trust wants $300,000 to restore a stretch of the Crystal River through Carbondale. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Earlier this month, Fort Collins, Coloradan reporter Nick Coltrane asked Colorado State University if there were inequities in pay between men and women, and discovered there were, but only after a lot of work. The school provided him with a printout of all the information, 150 pages of an Excel spreadsheet, rather than the files themselves. Coltrane's struggle to convert the printouts into something he could analyze prompted a battle about the public's right to access data. State House reporter Benta Berkland spoke with Coltrane about his story and the Colorado State Senate legislation it sparked.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Senate Bill 40 seems straightforward on its surface. Right now, government agencies aren't required to provide public information in a digital format. This bill would say If it's requested, it should be provided digitally. There are some guardrails around that, so not everything would go out. But it has been controversial. Explain what some of the sticking points are and why some groups have concerns about it.
As I understand it, the controversy has surrounded things like metadata, which is kind of all the information that's hidden in a file. Like, take, for example, a Microsoft Word document. It's not just the text on the screen. It's also a lot of background information. Probably the easiest example is the date the file was created, for example. That would be considered metadata. So if somebody is particularly good with computers, would they be able to go into the metadata or previous file versions, for example, and pull information out that would otherwise be protected information even under CORA?
I remember during the hearing in the Senate, people were concerned about privacy, the cost, things like social security numbers, and can that stuff be protected, which advocates say yes, and other people say, well, we're not sure. I want to talk about your particular case. The lawmaker leading this charge is Democratic Senator John Kafalas from Fort Collins, and he says what happened to you is what prompted him to bring this legislation. He tried last year, but it didn't pass.
This whole ball of wax kind of got started with concerns of pay equity across genders at Colorado State University, and so while CSU was kind of sussing through all of that, we also just got curious at the Coloradoan about larger pay issues. And so the first step to kind of us looking at it was to request basically a database of all of their employees and how much they're being paid. CSU said, sure, we have that, and pointed us toward one database they have online, but it didn't have some information we thought would be necessary to the reporting, such as individuals' names. Keep in mind, these are public employees. We pushed back a little bit more, said, no, we need this. And they said, okay, cool, we do have that. Just go to the library. And it's a spiral bound, about 145 pages, pretty clearly an Excel document that somebody just printed off. We wanted that in a digital format so we could actually get in and look at it, run some better analysis than just flipping through a book. And that's when Colorado State University said, no, we don't have to do that. We are adhering to the law by making this public information available in the library in a physical format.
You still analyzed the information. How long did that take?
Basically, I took my cell phone to the library, took a bunch of photos of every single page, then ran that through some programs that would convert images to text. As far as time commitment, I honestly don't like to think about it too much. It'd probably make me depressed. But a lot of time just with Excel going back and cross-checking.
If these records are being made public, but yet they're too difficult to analyze, it sounds like right now there's a lot of things that maybe aren't public after all. Because if you hadn't spent almost a month digging through this and converting everything, you wouldn't have had that information. A lot of people don't have the time or resources to do that.
A little bit of information can be a lot of bit of dangerous, right? So when you have these public entities, like in don't want to malign intent or motives or anything of that sort. Having information to get out there that is easily accessible, maybe manipulatable by less reputable sources, I could see where those concerns would be. And then also it is a valid concern that maybe some of the smaller municipalities or governments about Colorado, they don't have the staff or maybe the technical expertise to make sure that this protected information remains protected.
I know opponents have said it's not about journalists getting the information. They're worried about a lot of other groups and entities that request public records.
Absolutely. I have a very skewed viewpoint being a journalist, but there are a lot of companies out there that will specifically go after open records so that they can just mine data, whether about competitors or to get a bidding advantage in government contracts. The idea that just journalists use CORA is not accurate at all.
How important is it to your job?
Not to give a blasé answer, but it's very important to my job and just very important, I think, to maintaining the public trust between government entities and public. It could potentially save us a lot of man hours. It could allow us to provide a better window into the way our governments are operating.
Thanks. That was Nick Coltrane, a reporter for the Fort Collins Coloradoan. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Last Thursday in Parachute, traffic off one of the I-70 exits was wrapped around the block. The cars and trucks were in line to visit the country's first drive-through pot shop. NBC's Today Show was there, documenting it. So is Wyatt. He brings us this report.
Today, the Tumbleweed Express drive-through is hard to miss. Just look for the orange cones, the balloons, and the people beside the food trucks devouring pulled pork sandwiches.
I feel like I'm going to Disneyland, but I'm going to the weed shop.
Today is April 20th, 420, the unofficial marijuana holiday. And this grand opening feels like any other, except that the Marijuana Enforcement Division is in unmarked SUVs watching intently from across the street. James Seitz doesn't get to many grand openings. He's a handyman here in Parachute. Attendants walk up to his Ford 150 pickup. They start with a few questions.
So no weapons, THC, liquor in the car?
None.
No children?
Just children at heart.
Seitz is a regular at Tumbleweed's main dispensary just up the street. He marks his order on the menu that was brought to him.
So is the bronze shelf only for the eighths and higher?
Yeah.
Okay.
When his turn comes, the doors open and he drives into the building.
This is absolutely crazy.
And the doors close.
Can I see both your IDs, please?
The so-called bud tenders have his order ready.
All right, 1177, please.
It's cash only. Use the ATM if you're a few bucks short. The drive-thru will operate from 4 or so in the afternoon until midnight. It's for customers like Seitz, who know what they want and don't need much hand-holding.
I kind of call it the frequent flyer program.
Mark Smith is the CEO of Tumbleweed. The drive-thru was his idea. It came to him before opening the main store. One night, he stayed late to stain the floor. The lights were on, and people kept knocking on the doors and windows to see if he was open.
And I'm not talking 5 cars. I'm talking 20, 30 cars, 30, 40 people. It got to be kind of annoying.
But he got to thinking about the old car wash down the street. By law, marijuana transactions have to happen within 4 walls. But who's to say the walls can't move? And what's stopping customers from staying in their cars? Security cameras still record every transaction, just like at any other dispensary. No one under age 21 is allowed. The Tumbleweed drive-thru has been written up in places like ColoradoPotGuide.com and MaryJane.com, also Time Magazine, The Huffington Post, The Washington Post, and Reuters. The Today Show also reported on it.
Mark Smith is the CEO of Tumbleweed, a ganjapreneur.
Part of the interest, it seems, stems from Parachute. Before it was the Tumbleweed drive-thru, it was Valley Car Wash. That's when Ted Anderson ran it. The car wash made him good money, especially during the oil shale boom.
Then it went down. The whole community went empty.
Gas prices fell and the jobs left. Colorado legalized marijuana in 2012, but Parachute banned recreational sales. In 2014, the natural gas market tanked even further. The town expected sales tax revenue to fall and fall, but then, in 2015, the ban was lifted and pot shops started cropping up. According to Stuart MacArthur, who's the Parachute town manager, sales taxes have been growing by leaps and bounds ever since.
And I've got much more coming. I mean, that stack right you see behind you is all marijuana applications.
Back at the drive-thru, Ted Anderson is still taking it all in. Do you smoke marijuana? If you
don't mind
me asking?
No, I don't. No. I don't. I never have.
Will you ever?
Well, I wouldn't say never.
If you get some that tastes like bourbon, he might.
When Colorado voted whether or not to legalize marijuana, Anderson was against it. But now?
I guess you have to say it's progress.
Anderson will also take his truck through the Tumbleweed Express.
Have a good one.
No need to fill out a menu, though. He'll just be buying some hats and t-shirts. That's his way of witnessing history.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Claire Woodcock.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.